Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 4 of the Summer Library Podcast. I am Paul Sorrell, along with T.R. Parker. T.R., today is the last day of finals for the Spring 2012 semester. How do you feel?
I feel good. I feel like it's been a challenging semester in many ways. We've implemented a new catalog system, WorldShare, which from a user experience has been a big step forward, but there are a few bugs and kinks to work out with that. And so there have just been some challenges back and forth with that. And you know, I think people are tired, people are exhausted, but you know, most people probably by now, I mean, it's 11 o'clock, almost noon on Thursday. I think most people are done with exams. There may be a few tricklers with papers and assignments and projects to finish up and turn in. It feels good. It will be nice to have some time away from the office this summer, mm-hmm. And some time to work on projects and things that we want to continue to implement here at the library and, right. and get ready for the fall. So it does feel really good. I think we've come through the storm and we see the light at the end of the tunnel. The weather's been nice too in May. It hasn't been oppressively hot. There's been some cool breezes.
No, and we haven't had storm after storm after storm right. as we've had in the last couple of years. So that's always a relief when you're not dodging tornadoes or under the threat of tornadoes or severe weather. So that's been a change from the last couple of years. And I remember being a student here many, 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 many years ago, and just the relief of being through with finals and being through with the school year. And this school year has seemingly gone by really fast.
It has. They just keep going by. But it wasn't that many, many years ago, was it, Paul?
Yeah, it was.
I don't know, man. You're a young man.
It was quite a few. Yeah. Yes. So the library is moving on and upward, and we experienced our groundbreaking.
We did. That was nice. Nice ceremony.
Since our last podcast, we had groundbreaking back in April, and construction it will soon begin. And so in a very short time, we will be in a new space.
Yeah, I'm really really excited about this project. And as I understand it, there are rumors, and they've talked about actually turning over the dirt. We'll see some building maybe going on this summer,
yeah.
possibly, and some heavy machinery rolling out to next to the Miller Tower. We're going to get our new library at Union, and that's just so needed and so exciting for this university and this community. So mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll begin to see that, and you'll come back in the fall, and you'll be starting to see the beginnings of a new library at Union.
Yes, and across from where the library will be a special event on Saturday, which is graduation.
Right, and the chairs are already out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're setting up. So
mulch is out there.
Saturday morning. The mulch has an interesting smell.
It does. Interesting would be the interesting word
but,
for it.
But, yeah, the chairs are set up, and the weather seems to be nice, and so it's going to be a nice graduation. So many of our seniors this year walking, and I guess all of our seniors are walking.
Well, yeah.
Most of them. and it's just a good class, and so it's
been
nice to work with some.
And we will be losing a few of our student workers to graduation, and
yeah.
we have appreciated their work over
now,
the years.
Paul, which of our student workers?
Well, I know three are okay. Emily Watkins, Shanae Giffen, and there's a third, and I'm not really sure, but I know that there is a third.
Okay.
So thanks
well,
for putting
me
sorry, on
the spot
there.
Third student.
yeah, nothing like being put on the spot.
Yes. No, I'm sorry, Paul. But, you know, I just know these things better than I do.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
So
thank you to our student workers.
Yes.
Those named and unnamed.
And yes. And thank you to all our student workers throughout the years, because we certainly couldn't do our jobs without them. And speaking of things related to graduation, I guess our new faculty member of the year will be leading the procession, and I guess, and that would be
carrying the mace, right?
Yes,
yeah. Gavin Richardson, Dr. Gavin Richardson.
Yes, so. And he is our special guest for this podcast, and we will be back right after this to have a chat with Dr. Gavin Richardson, professor of English and the 2012 faculty member of the year.
Get in the mood. Get in the mood.
back, and we would like to welcome our special guest, Faculty Member of the Year and Professor of English, Gavin Richardson. Gavin, it's very nice to have you here on this last day of finals for the semester. And how are you?
I'm doing great, especially since finals are over and I just got to get in my grades and I'll be even better.
So you have graded all your papers and tests and things?
Well, I have. No, the answer is no, but I'm pretty close and I don't have a lot of papers this semester, so grading the exams much easier than getting through those papers.
Okay, and when you format an exam, are you thinking, what is easier to grade and more essay questions or more multiple choice? What do I want? Or do you think, what is the best way to know if the student knows what's been covered this semester?
That's a good question. You know, for these final exams, say in world literature, I will have a long answer portion that I know is going to be laborious to grade, and I do have a long essay portion. And the essay has to be composed in class. They can bring in a page of notes, but I think the art of extemporaneous writing is being lost, and I think that's a good skill to practice. And my exam is one place to practice that skill. But when I'm making out the first part of the exam, which consists of just short answer questions, I do. If I have a choice between a single answer question and one that requires two or three sentences, I'll try to minimize those two or three sentence ones so I can go ahead and move through part one pretty quickly. But I do feel a kind of pedagogical obligation to have some long answer questions on there so the students can demonstrate that skill.
Do you give the students blue books? Do you still use the blue books?
I require students to buy their own blue books.
Yes.
And I'm pretty old school. Sometimes I'll ask students, do you know what a blue book is? And no one will raise his or her hand. So, but I do require blue books. And rarely do I lose an exam. But if I lose an exam, it's almost always because a student forgot a blue book and had to write on notebook paper. The blue books tend to stay together for me for some reason. They stay in a pile. They stay in my book bag or whatever much more easily. If a student is writing on notebook paper, I tend to lose that, or it looks like every other piece of paper I have. Actually, I don't think I've ever lost an exam, but if I misplace one temporarily, it's because it's not in a blue book.
Right.
So.
Yes.
That helps me.
That would be a hard conversation with a student, I suppose. I lost your final. Can you retake it?
Well, you know, I'd probably err on the side of giving that student full credit or finding a way of prorating that. So it's never happened.
I recall the blue books well from my undergraduate years, getting to the point where you've been writing all day long in your hand. You can no longer write with your right, so you have to switch to your left or something like that. So I'm sure the students are enjoying that, but they'll be glad to be done, and some of them will be graduating this Saturday,
right.
So that's exciting.
Do you have a favorite course that you teach each semester, or do you like them all equally the same?
Well, I really enjoy teaching world literature, and that may seem strange because it's one of those courses that I teach over and over and over again, and that tends to be the kind of course that professors might have contempt for after a while. But I think world literature is so broad that I can vary the course or the text selection repeatedly from semester to semester to semester. And I kind of take a missionary – I kind of approach syllabus design with a missionary zeal. I feel like there's some great works that I like to introduce students to. And one of my most pleasing – things to do as a teacher is to design a syllabus. I really enjoy that because I feel like, oh, there's a great text that they're going to enjoy, or they may not enjoy this, but they need to know about that. So world literature is probably one of my favorite courses to teach.
So with this missionary zeal and this sort of introduction of maybe things that they've never known before, never read, what are some of those texts that you maybe go back to throughout the years or that are really you view as central to that?
The Quran is one text that I go to almost every semester, not every semester. But obviously Islam is in our news routinely, and I think that students may have a lot of opinions about Islam, but I don't think students have read much of the Quran itself. So it lends itself well to debate and discussion. I think the students are genuinely curious, even if they're not lit people, mm-hmm. you know, or they're not English majors or anything like that. I think they enjoy learning about Islam by going to the source and going to the Quran. So I think they find that text fascinating, and it's a good example of how a text that we might study in world literature has larger resonance outside the four walls of the classroom, so they can really see how this kind of text matters and this kind of course matters.
And do you approach that from a pure literature standpoint, or do you mix in faith and theology and philosophy with that, or is it just purely literature?
I wouldn't say it's pure literature. There's some times when we look at repeated refrains in a particular passage that might have a high literary content. But it is largely understanding what the Quran says, in what kind of culture the Quran developed. Obviously, it is inevitable, teaching at a Southern Baptist institution, an institution of faith. It's inevitable that we will discuss some comparative approaches to morality and ethics and theology. And the students are, you know, being union students, they're uniquely equipped, I think, to approach the Quran from their Christian perspective and to try to understand it within the framework of their faith. And we also look at some contemporary issues, such as, you know, the what some have called the Ground Zero Mosque debate in New York.
Right.
And we'll talk about those issues vis-a-vis the Quran. So the text lends itself to a host of pedagogical approaches, and it's one of the reasons why I enjoy teaching it so much. And plus, when I was in college, I took a year off, well, not a year off, I took my junior year abroad at the University of Leeds in England. And under the British university system, you have a month of winter break and a month of spring break. And during my winter break, a friend and I got a Let's Go guide and a backpack, and we went to Egypt. Hmm. And we backpacked through Egypt and stayed in youth hostels and cheap hotels. We went to Sharm el-Sheikh when there was nothing there, and now it's the Las Vegas of the Middle Eastern world. But I got to know Egyptians. I got to know Muslims, and I found them to be really interesting, kind, and humane, and generous people, and we don't always see that in our news today. So I was sort of teaching the Quran or teaching about Islam when it wasn't vogue to do so, long before 9/11. But I think since 9/11, it's become even more imperative to try to understand this culture and this religion. And an article in Christianity Today shortly before 9/11 made the very same argument.
Now, have you had any students balk when you bring up the fact that we are going to study the Quran? Have any just said, what do you mean we're going to study and read the Quran?
I've had one who has said that to me directly. I don't know how many students may have thought it and didn't say it, but I had one student say, I'm not sure why we're studying this or why we're learning about this, and I think she perceived disconnect between being at a Christian institution and studying the Quran. But I think most students appreciate the fact that we will go in and with a great deal of sensitivity look at the Quran and even if they had reservations on the outset, after a few days into the text, I think their anxieties are allayed a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you spent a year at the University of Leeds in England.
That's right.
And that was a year away from where you got your undergraduate work mm-hmm. done, which was in Nashville at mm-hmm. Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where are you from? Where did you grow up?
A small town in western Kentucky called Lewisport. It's about 100 miles southwest of Louisville, near Owensboro, Kentucky.
Okay. And what mm-hmm. drew you to Vanderbilt? I know it was the stellar athletic program.
Yes. Well, it was the football team, really. I think the reputation of the institution, Vanderbilt, a degree from Vanderbilt sort of opens doors that might otherwise be closed. But when I was graduating high school, I had a full scholarship at Transylvania University in Lexington.
I have heard of Transylvania. And the nickname is not vampires or anything like that.
No. But I had a scholarship to Transy, and I almost went there. But I didn't think I could afford Vanderbilt. So we met with some folks with who were connected with Vanderbilt Financial Aid, and to my surprise and my father's surprise, I remember that meeting, they came up with a significant amount of money that would allow me to go there and to make it possible. And my father, you know, and mother worked very hard and made that possible, and I'm deeply grateful for that opportunity. It was transformative, and the education there was first rate. And I think in some ways, you know, I got my PhD from the University of Illinois, but coming back and working in Tennessee, I think the Vanderbilt undergraduate degree may have gotten some attention here in Tennessee that allowed me to get the job at Union, right, you know, in 1998. So deeply grateful for that opportunity.
Now, going to Vanderbilt, and we're looking at some of your publications and hearing about your teaching interests, and we're sort of interested in at what point you begin to develop those interests. We've noticed that you're interested in medieval studies and the Quran and Shakespeare. You did a great presentation last semester The Merchant of Venice. But and so just out of curiosity, did you go into Vanderbilt knowing that you wanted to sort of go down the literature route? At what point did that become an interest, and how did Vanderbilt and the time in the UK as well help to form your interest?
I've done a lot of thinking about that question, and I recall when I was in first or second grade, I'm going back a lot further than you asked, I remember having this wool vest. This is probably, you know, 1974, 1975. And I would put on the wool vest, and I would say that I was a Harvard man. And I don't know where I got that as a first or second grader to call myself a Harvard man. I think maybe I'd heard it from my dad or something. If he saw me wearing this vest, he would call me a Harvard man. But I think very early on I had this ego ideal of being an academic. I had an affinity for English and for literature in high school. And I loved to read. And I remember in elementary school, my mother worked at a print shop. She worked on basically in 1977 or 78, it was a word processor that was, you know, as big as that door right there. Mm-hmm. Now we could probably do on our cell phone what that huge word processor would do. But my elementary school was very close to where she worked. And she worked about 4:30, 5 o'clock. But my school was out at about 3. So every day from about 3rd to 5th grade, after school, I would walk and spend an hour and a half, 2 hours in the library. Can you imagine a kid today spending an hour and a half or 2 hours in the library every day for 2 or 3 years during their grade school years? But I remember that was probably transformative in ways that I don't fully appreciate even today. But I knew going to Vanderbilt that I wanted to be an English major, and so that was pretty clear. It's not like I ever changed my major, The very fine faculty at Vanderbilt simply reaffirmed that interest and that love of literature, and were very encouraging. And I did well there and flourished there. What was surprising to me is I took Latin just to fulfill my foreign language requirement, but I fell in love with classics and ended up getting a double major in English and classics. And when I went to England, I took English and classics courses at Leeds.
Now, tell us a little bit more about the time in the UK. What led you to do that study abroad, and was that? Tell us about that time.
Yeah, I was obviously, as an English major, I was drawn to those traditions, that literary tradition, that cultural tradition. And so, I'd never been to Europe, and I guess I was up for an adventure. And the tuition that you would have paid to Vanderbilt, you know, you would just basically divert that, and it, you know, with the reciprocal arrangements, that's what you would pay to go to Leeds. Although I think mom and dad did pony up a fair amount of money for the for travel costs and things like that. So that was the annus mirabilis, to use a Latin phrase. That was the miracle year for me, my junior year. I met my wife there on the top of a Yorkshire Rider, you know, those double-decker buses. She wasn't British. She was actually a Vanderbilt student as well, but I didn't know her at Vanderbilt, and I only met her on the bus in Leeds.
Now, that's a great story.
Yeah, that is a great story. So, you know, I took Shakespeare there, and it's a situation where you take Shakespeare for a year, and then you go to Stratford, and you see the plays performed in Shakespeare's hometown. You know, you don't get those kinds of experiences anywhere else. And I took some very fine classics courses there, traveled a bit to Egypt, as I mentioned. In the spring, I went to France, Spain, Italy, Greece. A kind of mini grand tour for that month, and that was fantastic. And even though I was a junior, they sort of lump you in with all the first-year students in your dorms, and that was great camaraderie and, you know, times at the, as they call it, the disco were fun. So just a great all-around year.
Do you encourage your students to travel abroad and study abroad and do those things that you found to be beneficial and worthwhile?
If at all possible. And in fact, Michael Mallard and I, earlier in the, I guess, last decade, around maybe 2001, 2002, started the Union University in Italy program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not obviously a semester or a year, but it does get students to Europe for 10 days, 2 weeks. And by my count, we've probably been able to get over 200 students to have an overseas experience. I think it's best if you could do that for a semester or a year, but that's not always possible. And I think that once you get out of the country, I think you begin to look at your own country in a more robust, informed, three-dimensional, sophisticated, nuanced way,
mm-hmm.
Viewing its strengths and its weaknesses. And it's sort of like how I didn't learn English grammar until I took Latin. I don't really think you have an appreciation or an awareness of things that are uniquely American, both pro and con, until you go overseas.
Mm. Yeah, I got a chance my junior year to just study for the spring semester of my junior year in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so formative, maybe worth all of my other semesters combined, just
right.
In terms of how my perspectives changed and whatnot. Now, do you lead this trip to Italy often? Have you led that trip often?
I've done it three times.
Okay.
I've been to Italy four times, one time when I was in school. But three times we've taken students to Italy, and I'm so impressed with the Union University students.
Mm-hmm.
I can count on maybe, you know, three fingers the number of times that we've had any kind of, you know, problems with the students there. And I think that would be the envy of folks at other institutions who take students, college students overseas. So students behave themselves. They are curious. They're respectful. I think they're grateful for the experience too. So, yeah, I've done that three times, and would love to do it again. But obviously we got to share that with other faculty in the College of Arts and Sciences. And one of the great things about this program is that not only are we able to give students an international experience, some of our faculty have been able to travel internationally, and I think that's good for them too.
Yeah, they may need a librarian on that trip.
You think so?
Yeah.
All right,
get
yourself a new pair of shoes, and we'll go.
All right, sounds good.
All right.
Now tell us about your transition then to the University of Illinois, and
mm-hmm.
and I want to ask about libraries too, because the University of Illinois is sort of almost the mecca in the U.S.
Yes.
of librarianship, mm-hmm. if you will. They have the number one rated library school in the country. They're known for all of that, but that being said, what led you to go to the University of Illinois, and what did you study and focus on there, and how did that experience pan out?
Looking back, I'm shocked that I made as good of a decision as I did, because when I graduated Vanderbilt, I knew I wanted to get a PhD. I was either going to go to law school or grad school, and I think I missed the LSAT date or something. And that settled that. But I went to Illinois, and when I applied to about five or six grad programs.
And was this right out of Vanderbilt?
This is right out of Vanderbilt.
Yeah, senior year, you're applying.
That's right.
Right.
And I think I just looked in like a U.S. News and World Report to see some of the most highly ranked English graduate programs, and I think I picked Illinois out of that mix, really not knowing anything other than that. But I applied. I think I applied to Vanderbilt for grad school, Emory, University of Virginia, North Carolina, Illinois, and I got into all grad programs except for Emory, but I only got funded at Illinois, and I think that is, not surprising given the sort of overloaded market for PhDs. I just think that it's getting tougher and tougher, and folks were perhaps trying to limit, the number of applications even at that time. So I only got funded at Illinois, so that settled it. I would go and TA at the University of Illinois and had a great experience there, was fortunate enough to fall in with a great group of medievalist professors. Charlie Wright was my dissertation director, and he is a very prominent Anglo-Saxonist. Other folks on my committee, John Friedman, a Middle English expert, as well as Mariana Kalinke, who's an Old Norse Icelandic scholar. And these are very kind and generous and patient folks, and they shepherded me through my program. And, of course, as you note, the University of Illinois Library, I didn't appreciate it as much as I should have. But here's the acquisitions procedure at the University of Illinois. Okay, has it been published? Yes. Okay, let's get it. That's the acquisitions. And you look up stuff online, and almost always it was on the shelf, and you'd go get it. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't have it on the shelf, you got it through interlibrary loan.
And in addition to that, the state of Illinois has so many great universities, and they're known for just really advanced methods of resource sharing. So mm-hmm. in some crazy circumstance that they don't have it at Illinois, you can just get it from any of the other institutions. I think that the University of Chicago and Northwestern don't like to play as nicely with all of the state mm-hmm. institutions, but it has a reputation for just really great digital resources and fast resource sharing. So you pretty much have everything you need.
Well, and this was, this was in 95, right. 96, 97. Some of what we're talking about today has become available at a lot of institutions. Our interlibrary loan here at Union, I think, is very good. But in the late 90s, the University of Illinois was, far and away, I think, superior to a lot of libraries with respect to these kinds of procedures. And I know even as a grad student, I could log in from my machine, my computer in my office, and request a book, and they would have it in my campus mailbox within a day or two. They were delivering books like that at that time. And, of course, Mosaic and Netscape, these early web browsers were being developed at the University of Illinois at the time. So I was learning about, internet uses before the rest of the country knew about the internet, the rest of the world knew about it, because the earliest browsers were being developed at Illinois. So, it was just a great place for that kind of information technology to see developed.
Now, tell us about your library use. That was probably being a literature major and doing your – sounds like you did your dissertation. We'd love to hear about that in sort of medieval. We'd love to hear about your dissertation. Mm-hmm. But tell us about your dissertation, and tell us about, in the context of doing that, your library use.
Yeah. Well, my dissertation was called Truth is Trickiest, The Exploitation of Proverbial Discourse in Medieval English Literature. And basically it was about 400 pages on the way in which people in the Middle Ages used proverbs that imply a kind of universal accepted wisdom, but they were using them in highly self-interested, contexts and, you know, highly self-interested ways. So it's sort of exploiting this sense of universal wisdom that everybody agrees upon for very specific self-serving ends. And I was sort of looking at the tension between those two things. So, you know, this is the dissertation now is 13 years old, so it's hard for me to remember every jot and tittle. But I had a chapter on Beowulf, had a chapter on Mordarthur, the Mallory text, and, Laman's Brut, which is a 12th century, 13th century text. So, and in terms of library use, I mean, Illinois was indispensable. I mean, obviously a library is indispensable, but it was just especially helpful to be able to call up something and have them send it to you. And I was writing a lot of my dissertation in Chicago, where my wife was going to law school. So I would go to the University of Illinois at Chicago. And, you know, you talk about the state system. I was able to, as a Champaign-Urbana guy, go to University of Illinois at Chicago and still work there and have books sent to me there. And it's just it was a real blessing to have there. I do remember, I was sharing this last week at an academic conference with a fellow graduate of Illinois' program. I think one of the happiest moments of my life, outside of my marriage and the birth of my kids, was when I finished my dissertation and I deposited it, and I got to bring my, you know, three boxes of books that I had been living with for 3 years, and I got to return them to the to the library. So maybe librarians don't want to hear that. Oh, I guess you guys celebrate the return of books.
We have been books. Lately, actually. Yes.
That was one of the greatest moments of my
soliciting
life.
Soliciting the return of books.
Yeah, well, I returned those books that had been on my shelf for 2 or 3 years, and I was driving back to Chicago, and I just felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders. But, yeah, Illinois Library was a real blessing.
It's very symbolic. I still remember that experience as an undergraduate when you're done and you finished your blue books and you finished your papers, everything's turned in, and you can take that stack of books that's been sitting on your desk all semester and just, I'm done with it. I've wiped my hands clean.
Yes.
That's really great. Now, you mentioned Charlie Wright and others that you studied under and that you were able to learn during that time Old English and Norse Icelandic. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see if you would be willing to tell us, you know, give us a little sample of that.
Okay.
So you've got a book there. And
well, I do still teach the history of the English language, and I can read a little bit of Old English for you. This is – and when I say Old English, some people take that as a kind of generic term for like Shakespeare or Milton, but if it's a capital O, you know, Old English, we're talking about the language of the Anglo-Saxons, the pre-Norman conquest English that was spoken between, you know, 500 and 1100 AD on the British Isle. So here's a little bit of the Lord's Prayer in Old English. I'm actually going to read it from this book. It's cheating a bit because I require my students to memorize the Lord's Prayer in Old English when I teach the history of the English language, and they do a great job with it. But since I have a microphone in front of my face, I'm going to cheat a little bit. All right. So, Paul, I'm going to take a drink of my iced tea here.
All right.
We know you're in the South when you're drinking iced tea.
That's right. Here we go. Fader ur, thu the erot on heavenum, sithi nami a halgod. To bake me in richa, you were that in willa, on erdan swaswa on heavenum. Urn ye dewam hliken hlaf sula us today, an forgivus ur giltas, swaswa way forgiveth urum giltinum, and ne yelad thu us on kostunga, ak elusas of uvula, sothliche.
Now that was the Old English.
That was the Old English, and you omit thee, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. It just ends with anayilathu us on kosnunga, and lead us not into temptation, ak elus us of uvula, but free us, loosen us from, liberate us from evil.
Now, one of the things that I had to do in my high school senior English class, which I think many have to do this,
Canterbury Tales,
is memorize the prologue in the Old English. And I still remember some
that's
of it.
That's Middle English, technically.
Or Middle English, right. So that's what I was going to ask. Is that it's just a next phase of the language?
Right. As I explained Middle English to my students, if you take Old English, the language that I just read, which is essentially a Germanic language, if you take Old English and you sprinkle in Norman French and you stir for 300 years, you get Middle English. That's what you get.
Right, because of the Norman invasion.
That's right.
And, when that April, when the shore is so there.
Very good.
The
yeah.
root of March hath perished to the
road. You can still do it.
I can still do it.
You're a member of the club.
We were running. I was running cross country my senior year in high school, and we were all in the same English class. I remember running with four or five other guys and just reciting this because we had the test the next day while we were running.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have my students memorize that in the history of the language as well. And it is kind of like you're a member of a little club. I just had Aaron Mount email me the other day and said that she was in a job interview, and the interviewer had learned that she had, I guess, studied medieval literature. She has a master's from the University of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. She was a former student of mine. And somehow they got to both reciting the opening 18 lines of the Canterbury Tales. So there's all kinds of stories about running into people and in all kinds of circumstances and ending up, you know, reciting the Canterbury Tales.
Now that's Aaron. That's Stevens, our very own Stevens.
Correct.
Aaron.
That is correct.
Nice. Yeah. Right. They're just so great. Well, you were and tell us a little bit about then Norse Icelandic and about that language, and then you're going to do the Lord's Prayer in Norse Icelandic.
Right. Yeah. Old Norse Icelandic is it's the language of the Vikings. You know, and there are a lot of cognates between Old English and Old Norse Icelandic. They both come from Common Germanic, which is an outgrowth of Indo-European. But if you looked at the Old English and the Old Norse Icelandic side by side, you could pick out a lot of similar words. So I'm a little less confident in my Old Norse, but I'll give it a whirl here. And when I was in graduate school, I was in a group called the Old Norse Reading Group, and we would get together and read sagas like Njáls Saga or Volsunga Saga. And so my Old Norse was much better 13 years ago when I was with the Old Norse Reading Group. But here it goes, enough poor mouthing. Father Vaur, Sothe Eirtin Hifna, Helgas Nafenthit, Til Komathin Rika, Verdathin Villa, Sa'a Eorth Sama Hifna. Jevos ich dag vart daglich brauth, og firlat os osser skuller, so asm ver. Firlatum osm skuldenautum. Og in letho os, I e fresne, helder frels, thu os afilo.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
But you can hear, you know, like the Old English begins, Fader ur thu the erot on heavenum, you know, our Father who art in heaven. The Old Norse says, Father Vaur, so the Ert I Hifna. So Heavenum, Hifna, Father, Ur, Vaur. So you can pick up a lot of cognates from just listening to it.
It's interesting that you mentioned you studied Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very Germanic languages. So you're kind of covering, I guess, both all spectrums of the sort of Western European language traditions in that.
Yeah. And, you know, having studied Latin, you know, you have a broader picture of at least the Indo-European traditions in Western Europe, and you're better equipped to study Romance philology there. Would you like to hear the Lord's Prayer in Latin?
Absolutely.
Okay, see. All right. Pater noster, qui es in caelis, sanctificetur nomen tuum. Adveniet regnum tuum, fiat voluntas tua, sicut in caelo et in terra. Et dimitte nobis debita nostra, sicut et nos dimittimus debitoribus nostris. Et ne nos inducas in tentationem, sed libera nos a malo. Yeah. I'm pronouncing that with probably an early Latin pronunciation. When I took Latin, I learned sort of the Latin of Virgil, and I didn't really learn ecclesiastical Latin, and sometimes, you know, a letter like C would be pronounced as ch before a front vowel, E or I. But that's pretty close, I suppose. And, you know, it's nice when I teach. I mean, I like to be able to read texts in their original if I'm going to study them or teach them. I can't always do that in World Lit. I don't know Sanskrit. I don't know Arabic. But when I teach Virgil's Aeneid or when I teach the poetry of Catullus, I'll bring in a bit in the Latin just to give them a taste so they can appreciate what it sounded like in the original, that so they can appreciate that Virgil is writing poetry, and they can hear the verse forms of the opening of something like the Aeneid. Arma, whatamque cano, Troia qui primis abortis. You know, you could hear that little lilt. The opening of Beowulf, I'll read it in Anglo-Saxon so they can hear that this is poetry with a distinctive rhythm. Huat we gardena in yardagam, theod kuniga thremia frunan, hu the adalengas elan thremadon, of shil shaving, shathan a threat, a monogam, magatham, medsa, of tea. You can hear that marching beat of Beowulf and the alliterating staves. It just hits you over and over again, and you miss that in translation.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to these languages, there is a more universal language that you are very interested in, and that would be the language of music.
Mm-hmm.
And you are a musician, and you are also, and I'm sure a lot of people know this, mm-hmm. You do Elvis impersonations. Is
the term is tribute artist.
Oh, tribute artist. Far be it for me to get that wrong. So you are an Elvis tribute artist. Do you ever pull out any of these languages while you're...
I do not pull out Elvis, the language of Elvis. I will say the whole Elvis thing got started. I haven't done it in a couple of years, so the present tense verb may be problematic there. Let's say I am an Elvis tribute artist. Maybe I'm a recovering Elvis tribute artist. But my mother-in-law, I used to goof on Elvis, and my mother-in-law actually took the time and trouble to make a jumpsuit for me.
Wow.
Yeah. And now that jumpsuit's pretty ratty because you can't wash it because it has all these sequins on it, so you can't, like, take it to the dry cleaners or whatever. And I think a Coke bottle exploded on me one time, so it's pretty ratty. So anytime I do Elvis, after I had the jumpsuit, of course I had to do some Elvis to justify the jumpsuit. But pretty much anymore, if I do it, it's for some kind of charitable function. I think the last time I did Elvis, there was a camp for autistic children at the Jackson, it wasn't the YMCA, it was Westwood Gardens. And they were, for whatever reason, they were studying Elvis or studying rock and roll as a kind of all-camp focus for that week. And Margaret Dugan asked me to come out and do Elvis for that, so I was happy to do that. And I've also, there was another, I think it was like an Easter Seals camp at Mount Juliet, and I had a friend who was running it, and she asked if I could come up and do Elvis, so...
So can you do the Lord's Prayer in Elvis?
I don't know. I don't think I'll do it in front of a microphone.
Would that be irrevereant? I don't know.
No, he was a great gospel singer.
That's where he won his Grammys, in gospel music. So.
Well, Dr. Richardson, how does it feel to be Faculty Member of the Year? And I know you want to be humble, too, but what do you think it is about your teaching? I understand you've been nominated for this several times. And when you won, everybody was really happy, and it was sort of no surprise because, he's one of our really cherished faculty members. How does that feel, and what do you think it is about your teaching that has caused you to be Faculty Member of the Year?
Well, obviously it's very gratifying. As I understand it, I think that recognition is a product of both a faculty vote and a student vote. I served as faculty forum president this year, and I suppose that probably accounted for some faculty support. But with respect to, the student side of things, I try to teach with a very high sense of obligation to my students and to this university. And as I told the Cardinal and Cream, it seems like, that this recognition simply means that somewhere along the way somebody noticed that I try to be prepared, and I try to teach with that sense of obligation. But I really love what I do. I mean, I love being in the classroom. I love my students, mm-hmm. and I love reading and thinking and talking about literature. And I think that's translated to the students. But to be a little bit more specific, a lot of this sounds kind of generic. I think I'm pretty good at being able to make complex, difficult literature accessible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, taking a Shakespeare play like such as Coriolanus, which is a play that I taught at the end of this semester. You know, we began by acting out Coriolanus for the first 15 minutes of class. Each student, or not each student, but about a dozen students have individual lines. And we move through the play in a kind of, you know, theatrical fashion and through the use of, you know, close reading of the text and PowerPoints and images and you know, interview clips with actors such as Gerard Butler, who plays Tullus Ophidius in the latest production of Coriolanus that's coming out at the end of this month. I think I'm pretty good about making this stuff accessible without dumbing it down. And that's a hard balance. You know, how do you make a Shakespeare play accessible to your students without saying, and still saying, don't cliff note it, don't spark note it, don't monkey note it, don't no fear Shakespeare it. You know, you gotta wrestle with the text. But I tell them, if you go through these steps, if you read the text, if you pay attention in lecture and you give that a shot, and if you watch a performance on DVD or what have you, you know, you might not understand Shakespeare upon first reading, but if you go through these processes with me, then by the end of these processes, after 3 or 4 class days on the text, you'll get a handle on it. You know, and I also tell my students, you know, give yourself a little room to fail at the very beginning. You're not going to understand everything. Don't let that make you feel stupid. It's okay to. This is not the back of a cereal box. The Odyssey, the Quran, Coriolanus, you know, Hamlet. These are tough works of literature that you can acquire, but it's going to be a process, right? And I think students are encouraged by that, and maybe that accounts for their recognition of me here in the past couple weeks.
Well, we want to congratulate you for this honor.
Yeah, this is great.
And we want to thank you for joining us today in our podcast. And it's been very interesting, and we've learned a lot about you and saw all different sides of you, and we just appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, fellas.
Congratulations again.
Thanks.
So thankful for him being here and speaking in Old English and Norse Icelandic and just telling us a little bit about himself. It's nice to get to know him a little bit. And so thank you.
And we're still waiting for the Elvis version of
the Lord's Prayer.
And we're going to hold him to that.
We'll hold him to that. And maybe you could do it, Paul.
Maybe. Maybe not. And we also want to say congratulations to all the students who will be earning degrees this weekend. And I know that they are relieved, and it's a great feeling to have that part of your life behind you. So
we hope you have a great summer. And remember that if you're taking classes this summer or when you come back in the fall, the summer library is where
studying every day
could help you perform better academically. Or could help you graduate.
That's right.
Have a good summer, everybody. Thank you.
Bye.